Session number 14806.
Eddie Murray, side 20.
We've covered this little question of the attitude between the Brits and the Americans and so forth. Tell me, what was the situation with the intelligence corps? Did you...
No, we were entirely apart.
No, you said you cooperated with the intelligence corps.
Did I?
Yeah.
I'm sure that, well, it must have been at a higher level than I.
Ah.
You see? I mean, I fed the information.
I said, what hat badge?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So, yes, the army officers, the regular army officers of ISLD, went around in general staff uniforms.
And were there many people from the intelligence corps in ISLD?
No. None at
really?
All.
None at
None
all?
At all. Uh-uh.
Really?
Uh-huh. Quite sure. But we were an entirely separate organisation from the whole of the British Army, really.
So you were an SOE type or?
Absolutely. Yes, yes,
right,
indeed.
As opposed to the intelligence corps.
Yes, it has been referred to as that.
And what, the Force 136 or whatever it was that the correct title?
Yes.
Yes. Was that intelligence corps or SOE? Or don't you know?
Don't know. Mm. All I know is that... occasionally we asked them to cooperate and they asked us to cooperate and there was
right.
a distinct cooperation, but a certain amount of competitiveness, if you like. But I feel sure that they were in a sort of a different field to
right. And so how long did you remain in charge of this officer's mess?
Well, until I left in January.
January 46?
Yes.
And
August, so that was, about
four or five
months.
Right.
During that first period that I was in Calcutta, of course, I'd gone to Chandanagore under my own steam to collect my wages, which is something I didn't mention before.
Well, tell me that briefly, yes, please.
That's all. It's
done. Okay.
It's done. I just had to pick up give my warrant number and all the rest of it and... show I didn't have any proof to show, really. But I met up with two or three colleagues, like Svoboda, who were in the hospital there.
All right.
And then I signed and picked up my money and went back to Calcutta.
Right. So were you able, more or less, to sort of stabilise your position, if I can put it that way? Had you got used to being...
Oh, yes. I mean, I was immediately integrated my,
From the Foreign Legion, I
from the Foreign Legion, yes, indeed. I seemed to slip into this this new role, without any trouble at all. But I was, absolutely always aware of the fact that I should consider myself to be very, very lucky indeed to be in such a position and to have such a responsibility. But that, on the other hand, that they wouldn't have done it if they hadn't felt that I was capable of the responsibility. And so, I felt very, very responsible myself and confident that I could carry out, until I made the boob.
Yes.
And I've never forgotten and never forgiven myself for doing it. But then, of course, so many wonderful things have happened to me since.
Yes.
I think that it was destiny that meant that I should unshackle myself from that blooming dispatch case,
right.
which only contained personal letters and mail, from what I could understand.
Yes.
And in fact, they were all wrong because they said that there was another packet inside of that. And so I disputed the fact and I said, no, I'm quite sure that I only signed for one case. And if there had been another case inside, I'd have signed for two. And I'd have asked to see the second case and all that sort of thing. So don't give me that blooming rubbish. And they looked around and they looked around and I was proven not guilty.
Oh, well, but something anyway, yes. Did you find it a bit unreal, all this suddenly being from one world to another, if I can put it like that?
Yes, it was definitely that sort of an atmosphere, the unreal atmosphere. And here was I doing, the stuff that only appears on films or in books.
So does the Foreign Legion, but in a different way.
Yeah, in a way, yes, of course. Yeah, that I can understand. And so...
Had you made better contact now with your family? writing and so forth, you knew what was going on?
I felt sure that I received right. quite a number of communications from my family.
How long did you stay? After you finished at finished there in January 46, where did you go to?
First class passenger, civilian passenger, of course, back to Britain.
Okay.
There were quite a number of personalities aboard. We were five of us, and I've got a.
Okay.
I've got their signatures on a 1,000 yen, a 1,000 yuan, or
it's
tuan, yuan,
Chinese
note.
Right.
Still got it. One of them was Margaret Burton, who was quite famous, as a matter of fact, as an Ensa singer, contralto. She died, you know, and there was a, the Daily Telegraph, you know, gave an obituary. And Jimmy Horrocks was also, you know, on the boat. We were first-class passengers. It was a troop ship, the Strathmore. And we went back from Karachi. And I was a very, very important person, as a matter of fact, because I had two big tin cases amongst my luggage, which were in my cabin. And, of course, I'd taken quite a lot of hooch with me, gin and whiskey. And nobody else, you see, it was a dry ship. And so I was able to...
Because it was a troop ship?
Troop ship.
Right.
And so, of course, I was... the other people were very, very lucky to have me as a friend.
Right. What I was going to
But
ask
Jimmy Horrocks was one of the five. And Jimmy and I stayed friends. And we're still friendly with his wife, who's now retired to a retiring home, do you see, down in Dorking.
Right.
We went to see her the other day. Now, Jimmy was with the Times, he was with Reuters, I think, at the time, but then he passed on to the Times and he came down to see me at Chartwell, you know, on official business, that sort of thing. And but we kept on. We used to go to the Savoy, meet in the Savoy together, and I used to pass him items of information that I felt relevant and discreet. But Jimmy was to become very important on the in the Express on the Hickey column.
All right. Okay.
You scratch your back, my back, and I'll scratch yours.
Right. I was going to ask you: did you find it difficult to behave in a British manner and to speak English after all this time in a French environment, and to a lesser extent, not have French food and French wine on the table all the time?
That's a good question, really, because even today I can come up with a French word and have to look for, and very, very often not find, for quite a while, an English word. But my wife is French-speaking as well. She was brought up in Switzerland from the age of 3. Her father was Swiss and her mother was English. She learned French at school and Italian. And German, of course, and so, you know, it's a multilingual place as our home.
Do you speak French at home?
We've got grandchildren who are learning French, and so when they come, you know, I often enough lapse into French.
Right.
And it comes, in fact, I think that my French is actually more academically correct than my English.
Really?
Okay. I find less difficulty in finding the correct word and the correct phraseology, shall we say, in French than I do sometimes in English, because English is it's a funny language on occasions, you know. There's a split infinitive and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Which doesn't come into the French language. And lots and lots and lots of other things.
Speaking English, did you find that a bit difficult?
At the beginning, really.
No.
But I'm sure that for quite a long time I preferred to speak French.
Yes.
But I'd been given English lessons, do you see?
Yes.
So I'd been practicing my English throughout the years that I was in the Foreign Legion.
But in a sort of broken way, I expect, if you see what I mean.
No, not really. Speaking correct English.
What about not having wine on the table and not having French food and generally being in a French atmosphere?
We always have wine on the table on Sundays.
But
today.
But in...
In India?
Yes.
No. As I said, I was in charge of the officers' mess.
So you are
so
right.
We had lots and lots of wines, although the majority of the English people seemed to drink beer. Mm. But nevertheless, the wines were there and the good French food. And we had, as I said, a wonderful cook who did French cuisine.
Right. What nationality was the cook?
Indian.
Indian, yes.
And he was big and fat.
Goanese?
You know, you might be right. I wouldn't argue, but I feel, I've got a feeling about that.
They're good cooks.
Yeah.
Right. That is enough for today. We've finished with Southeast Asia, and we're now back to
Britain.
Europe, back to Britain, back to Europe. So thanks very much indeed, and we'll resume there where we left off the next time. Well, we'll resume again on another day on the same tape. We've got to the point where you're just going off to the... returning to England, and how long would it have been you left in...
Not quite 10 years.
Not quite 10 years. I was just going to recap perhaps over some of the time of your time in the Far East and in the Legion. I was wondering, what did you actually think of the Japanese as troops and then also as individuals from having been put out by them at close quarters?
You know, but we never had any time or the opportunity or the inclination really to stop and talk to the Japanese. Mm. And I'm sure that they were under strict orders not to talk to us.
Okay.
But as far militarily, I'm quite sure that I personally realized that we were sort of not on speaking terms, that they were disciplined, you know, throughout. And whenever one saw them marching around Hanoi or even around Tong, patrolling, shall we say, they were always disciplined. And although, you know, I think we've gone into this once before.
Okay. What about the Indians and did you meet the Japanese later? Because you mentioned that.
Oh, yes, in 1969.
Oh, okay. We'll come on to that.
Yes,
did you have any particular observations about the Indians and how the Indians and the different sort of castes and so forth and how they were treated by the Brits or how you expected they might be?
No, as a member of the... well, I was an intelligence-like, but I considered myself to be a member of the ruling forces, shall we say, during the time of the Raj, it was, that... And, of course, it was common procedure not to take any bit of notice of either Indians, per se, or the half-castes, you see. And there were so many, although I had to deal with them, I went out with for instance, when I was in charge of the mess at Calcutta, I used to go out with the chef, and then I met up with quite a lot of Indian merchants and found them quite respectable people to talk to. But there was always the underlying feeling that they were bowing to my superiority, really. And I was usually in either a major's or a captain's uniform. But, you know, anything that I said or anything that a European said to an Indian was more or less an order and coming from a superior to an inferior. That was the way it was. But then there was the other side of it, that the half-castes themselves, and I must say that the majority of the half-caste women that I encountered in both in Calcutta and down on the Bay of Bengal and elsewhere in India were usually very, very beautiful persons, you see. So I didn't mind talking to them. But the normal Indian was averse to having any conversation or any contact at all with the half-castes.
Really?
I sort of pitied them, really. But they seemed to be making progress, and they were...
But they were better off, generally, than most of the Indians.
Generally speaking, of course, there was an Indian population that was, you know, very high class and very well off indeed, like Pandit Nehru, and the other one, I couldn't remember his name the other day, still can't. But there were a lot of Indians who were very, very well off indeed, and quite a lot of them were merchants, and dealing with the British, really.
Mm. Was there any resentment at all towards the Brits?
Not outward resentment. No, not at all. Mm. In fact, when we went to, you know, when I remember going into Prince's, which was, you know, a big restaurant and that sort of thing, and dance place and that sort of, you know, when I went to different restaurants where it was always, there were always Indian personnel serving you, there didn't seem to be any resentment at all, provided that you tipped them, you know.
Right. But, I mean, were those places effectively segregated, or the big hotels?
No, there didn't seem to be any segregation at all, except that, yes, the caste system, of course, did play an important part in it, but in the non-European parts of the city of Calcutta, for instance.
Did you find the Indians treating each other badly? Or
Yes, indeed, I'm quite sure they did. Yeah. But it didn't affect us, and so...
Well, I mean, could you give a... Can you remember, or...
No, it was just a feeling I had. Yeah. Because, I mean, we just... me, personally, I had nothing against them, but I saw that it was common practice by military personnel, particularly, not to have anything at all to do with the Indians, if it were at all possible.
Okay. What did you feel about the other people that on the SOE side of it, or whatever, the intelligence side that you were dealing with? I mean, you've been in the thick of it for a long time. I mean, had some of these people just come off the boat, or if they hadn't just come off the boat, had they wound up in some sort of cushy number out in India? Did you feel that, or did you feel that you knew all about it?
All the people that I had anything to do with, as far as the intelligence side of it was concerned, each of them had a role to fill, and each of them was filling that role as best he could, and there was not much communication of the roles between personnel, shall we say, of the different roles that they were filling.
No.
They didn't talk about the things that they were doing. Mm. Some of them had come back from Burma and Malaya, and some of them, of course, had just been recruited into the organization and were wondering what was going to happen to them. But nobody was able to tell them, or was in a position, or really felt that they ought to tell the newcomers what they were going to do, because they just didn't know. That was top secret information held only in Calcutta. And when they came to me, I was able to put them in the picture as far as the training was concerned and the routine that they were to follow. But as far as their future deployment was concerned, I myself didn't know.
Did you feel that the people that you were dealing with, I'm not talking about the people you were training, but I mean fellow instructors and officers, were as experienced as you were?
Oh, what a good point. I'm sure that, you know, we had the finest possible instructors, and I'm sure that some of them were much more versed in the electronics side of it, if you like. But as far as military tactics were concerned, then I felt that I was in a position to discuss these matters professionally, do you see, with the instructors that were there. But I was there really to supervise the whole camp, or the camp as a whole, rather than interfere with the training. But if I felt, while I was attending some of the lectures that were being given, for instance, by tacticians or by military personnel, then I'd be able to put my oar in. But never, ever did I feel that I was more qualified than any of the instructors that were there at the particular camp.
Okay. I was wondering how they verified your identity as you sort of presented yourself. I mean, you said...
That was a bit...
By the way, we'd like you to become an instructor. I mean, most people, when they wind up in a different environment, very often you have to start not only convincing them that you know what you're on about, but you also have to start from the bottom. I mean, with the Foreign Legion, you could have done 15 years in the British Army and joined the Foreign Legion, and they say, well, all right, well, you start from the bottom here. I mean, I, you know,
Yes, this was, you know, I've often looked back on it and wondered, you know, how they came to the conclusion that I was the best man, you see, to go down and take over from the major that was, that had been in command of this training camp. And I've never come up with an answer, really, except that the fact that I got into India without any identification at all. And then, of course, came a very, very, what I considered to be a most depressing, it was, really. What can I say? It didn't lift up my spirits at all, the fact that for an identity card, I had to go down into the middle of Calcutta to another place, a war, British military place, real military. And I was interviewed by a woman lieutenant, you know, who signed my identity piece. And I thought that was really a come down. I thought that was a disgraceful
thing.
And she asked me questions about my father and my, you know, and about home, really, and my home address and all that sort of thing. And then the pass was issued, you know, immediately as a civilian officer. I wasn't very happy about it.
Was this before or after you were appointed?
This is, this was before.
Right. This was merely to establish your identity.
Within the first, yes, just, well, no, not to establish my identity, really. I mean, it was merely to give me a pièce d'identité, an identity
card. I see. But who else was there? I mean, was sort of displaced people?
I can't remember, except that there was only she and I in this office, you see, and afterwards I was issued, which I've still got at home.
Really?
Except, yes, I have it at home. Have I got it here? I might have it here, as a matter of fact, but still. It's,
What explanation did they give you of the organisation? I mean, you know, there's one thing, who are you, but who are they? Oh, by the way, we'd like you to be a spy, or maybe not a spy, but train other people to be a spy.
It was a remarkable thing, do you see? Because there was a jeep waiting for me at Dum Dum Airport, and I was taken into the middle of Calcutta and dropped off at this office, and I went straight in, and the bloke on the door, you know, at the reception, if you like, what was he, captain, I'm sure, at least, and he was there at reception waiting for me, you know, said, and who are you? And I said, well, I'm so-and-so, Edmund Murray, do you see? And I don't know who I've got to see, but I've just come from China. And he said, that's all right, Mr. Murray, we know who you are. And then he took me in to see the colonel, who was in command of the whole organization. And there, the P's and Q's would explain to me about what the organization was, but briefly it was. And then, he said, now what we're going to do is to send you down to a training camp. And that was all
so
I knew about it.
A revelation, really.
Absolutely, a revelation. Ah, wait a minute. Now then, I did spend 2 or 3 days in Calcutta, in that particular building, shall we say, in the center of Calcutta, before being transported up to Ballygunge, to the out-of-town house, if you like, of the organization. And I was taught or given a very, very quick introduction, shall we say, to coding and decoding. And it was brief, and it was quick, and it was sharp, but I picked it up very, very quickly.
This was on what, on Morse?
No, not on Morse, no, on ciphering.
On letters?
Yes, mainly. Of course, the point is that I know that people like Hewitt and guards...
Hold it, we've got a trail.
Oh, dear.
Right, well, we're starting again. We've just rudely been interrupted, and we've had to change location because they started drilling outside, so we're now recording from the cinema inside the Imperial War Museum, the viewing room. And you were saying that you were kept several days inside the in or kept several days in size of exaggeration. You were stayed several days immediately after you arrived in Calcutta at a particular place where they eventually asked you questions about your identity, as far as I could gather.
You know, I can't remember very, very much in about the whole of that process.
Mm.
And I feel myself that there wasn't very much of an interrogation
mm.
as far as my past was concerned, except where I was born, how long I'd been in the Legion, and some, I suppose, facts about my Legion story. But I know it, you know, it went very, very quickly indeed, and I was surprised at the lack of interrogation because of the important jobs that they immediately set me on.
Mm.
And within days, there I was on my way down to down the Bay of Bengal to take over mm. this command of a training camp.
Presumably they felt that your experience was fairly unique. I can only assume, I don't know.
Well, they must have been impressed by it anyhow, because, you know, immediately I got down there the next day, the major and I was taken I was taken over the command of the camp from, he returned to Calcutta practically within hours. We just had time to organise this party that I
yes.
told you about.
Okay. Right. I was going to say, so what your actual identification was, so you got an ID eventually, and it said you were on this inter-service. If somebody stopped you and said, why are you wearing this uniform, a captain or a major with a general service, then you got, what was your identity? You got a mister in the, and if the military police stopped you, what have you got mm-hmm. to show who you were?
Well, I'm quite sure that they would, you know, I don't think they would have taken me into custody, but they would have made inquiries
yeah.
to find out from their office, I suppose.
What I was saying is, what was your official unit on your, what was your official regiment or unit on, and rank on the paperwork?
There was no. There wasn't any written authority for me to don military uniform.
Okay.
I did that, I suppose, because I'd been told that it was permitted,
okay.
provided that we didn't advertise the thing.
Okay. Right. I just one thing on that we didn't cover, and that was the in the Legion, the actual uniform you had. And I know that what, we were in topies and shorts and putties. Or?
When first we landed out in Indochina, we were in topies, but this topi business was disregarded eventually and discarded, shall I say?
Yeah.
Within weeks of our arrival in Indochina, and the KP was adopted with the forage cap. The KP was for going out uniform, and the forage cap for work.
Okay, so right, and you had the shorts and puttees or something
during the summer or the warm hot periods. And don't ask me, you know, when mm. were they?
No.
Hot periods, but because most of the time it was the hot periods, but during the cooler seasons we wore knee breeches and putties and boots. But in the warm period, of course, it was shorts and short-sleeved shirts. Yes, we did. When we were wearing the knee breeches, whether they were the heavy type, heavy khaki serge, rather than the lightweight summer uniform knee breeches, but we still always wore the cummerbund, the blue cummerbund,
uh-huh.
when we were going out and onto town, on the towns, if you like.
Mm.
And I remember this so well because I had this friend of mine, whom I mentioned in my book, he was a professor at Heidelberg University and was destined for the cloth, the Catholic cloth. And then he joined the Legion, and my time he'd been in there, you know, for a good 15 years, did Driesch. And he was at the military academy, later to be massacred, killed by the Japanese. But I can see him standing there at Via Tree. He He was a real stickler for cleanliness and uniform, typical German, really, of the aristocratic German, if you like, that everything had to be, there was a place for everything, and everything had to be in its place, and your boots had to be polished, and your putties had to be on quite correctly, and the cummerbund had to be folded at exactly the right place, on halfway round to the right, halfway between the ribs, shall we say, or the right-hand side and the belly button, if you like. It had to be exactly in the middle there. And how many times have people been turned round and gone back about 50 or 100 yards or so to put their cummerbund on right? But everything had to be really polished. And I can see Dries doing this.
Yes. But it was really, at the time, was it quite old-fashioned sort of uniform, would you say?
Oh, yes.
Even at the time?
Even at that time, yes.
Right.
It was the Legion uniform, and there was no getting away from it.
Right, let's just...